Welcome back. This class is Unintended Consequences, although actually I think it might be more aptly titled Intended Consequences, because the Aedeem Zomamim intend for a consequence to happen, but they don't succeed. So maybe it's intended non-consequences, but that didn't really roll off the tongue. So here we are, and we're back. And just to refresh our memories, because it's been a while, we are talking about the category of Aedeem Zomamim, and Aed Zomame is a category of false witness. This is somebody who testifies against someone else, okay? And then a second set of witnesses, right, which I always call witnesses B come and say, it is impossible, absolutely physically impossible for you to have seen what you claim that you saw, because you were with us somewhere else, okay? That's the core thing that we learned last week, that an Aed Zomame is contradicted, not based on the content of his testimony, but on the fact of the testimony. Was that witness actually in a place where they could technically see the event? If witnesses B can establish, okay, that witnesses A, the first witnesses, the Aedeem Zomamim, okay, that it was actually impossible for them to have seen what they claimed they saw, that's the case where the Aedeem Zomamim are punished. If the second set of witnesses come and they say, but that's not right because you're talking about someone who, you're claiming this person is dead, but like I saw him at the supermarket. Like obviously based on the facts on the ground, this didn't happen the way that you said it happened. In that case, right, the way that we think about the witnesses are two competing narratives. Okay, you say this, I say that. We got to do a little bit more research, but we don't look at the first witnesses as being Aedeem Zomamim, as being canceled. We look at it as Eide hachasha, contradicting testimony, and we need to figure out how we're going to navigate this. It might be that neither of them are believed, okay? And that, but in the case where it's merely a contradiction and not a real case of Aedeem Zomamim, the big difference is whether or not the first witnesses are going to get punched, okay? If the testimony was just about the facts of the case, the whereabouts of the victim or the perpetrator, anything like that, then we just throw out the testimony, but nothing happens to the first witnesses. But if it's a case where I said, you have to be lying because there's no way you could have seen what you saw, in that case, I would absorb, right? I, the Aed Zomame, would absorb whatever penalty I was trying to trigger. Okay, so if it's a capital case, I will be put to death. If it was a monetary case, I would have to pay, right, whatever amount I would have cost the person I testified against. Okay, that was the exciting thing about last week. Last week, the important thing that we learned was that the second set of witnesses, their testimony has to be about the whereabouts of the first witnesses, because that cancels the possibility of their testimony. And that's what we learned last week. This week, we're going to talk about what seems like a technicality, but I think is actually gets a little bit more deeply into one of the abiding questions in this whole thing that we're going to keep on coming up against over and over and over, which is we always seem to believe witnesses number two, right? Witnesses B. But even when it seems like there might be reasons not to believe them, okay? And today we're going to be talking about when there is a numerical disparity, okay? What if witnesses A was a group of 700 people who all said they said something, and then witnesses B are only two guys? Two versus 700, okay? Do we ever say majority rules and we go with the first set of witnesses? Okay? Spoiler, we never do. Okay, we never say majority rules. We just look at them as one set of witnesses that happen to have 700 members and another set of witnesses that happen to have two, and they have equal weight and equal value. And the fact that it's so many people in cot A, right, in the first set of witnesses, that does not at all impact whether or not we believe them, okay, vis-a-vis the second set of witnesses. It's going to become more clear when we see all of the Mishnayot. Today's a very Mishnah-heavy class. We're going to do a bunch of Mishnayot to start. And the thing that is going to string all of these different Mishnayot together is, how do I establish who is in a set of witnesses if I have more than two people? Obviously, if I have only two people and they come together, I'm like, you are my set. But what if I have three or four or five, right? How do I determine who is in the set? And does it matter if there are more than two people in a set? Okay. So first we quote the pasuk in Devarim, al pi shnayim edim o shlosha edim yumat hamit. A person can only be put to death through eyewitness testimony, okay? On the testimony of two witnesses or three witnesses, okay? That's a very odd verse. You should all, if your rabbinic glasses are on, you should all be very upset. Because if I know that two witnesses are sufficient and two witnesses make a case, why are you telling me two or three? That is fuzzy math. We don't like fuzzy, okay? It should say, al pi shnayim edim yumat hamet. A person can only be put to death on the testimony of two witnesses, okay? So now the Mishnah is going to ask, if the testimony is sufficiently established, mitkayemet, through two witnesses, why does the pasuk say three? Lama pireda katuv bishlosha? You're not telling me anything. I know that three is more than two. So if two is sufficient, obviously three is sufficient. And then we come and we say, well, this is to teach me something about the nature of a set of witnesses where there are three members. This is to compare two to three. Just as three are competent to incriminate two as perjurers, I will say this in regular English in a second, so are two competent to incriminate three as perjurers. Okay, essentially the language, okay, in the Mishnah of to incriminate here is mizimim. Mizimim is essentially, I am establishing someone else to be an eidzomim. If the witnesses A, okay, the initial witnesses, the people who are being accused of eidim zomimim, okay, if there are two of them, and then the eidei hazama, the people that are testifying against them, witnesses B are three, okay, if it's three versus two, that testimony is going to be valid, okay, witnesses B are going to be believed, okay, but similarly, okay, here's the exciting piece. If there are three people who are the original witnesses, witnesses A, versus two people who are the people that are claiming that those first witnesses are perjurers, okay? Even though there's three people in the category of witness A and only two people who are de hazama, the only two people who are coming to say that they're wrong, we don't say, oh, but three versus two. We don't pay attention to how many numbers. How many members there are in the set. Just as two could contradict three, so two, three can contradict two. Okay? And then the Mishnah goes on, how do we know? Okay? Even 100, afilu mea, talmud lomar edim. Okay? The pasuk could have said, al pi shnayim o shlosha edim, yumat hamit. I only need one presence of the word edim in my verse, since I have a second time it says edim, which seems extra. Rabbis love extra words because that gives you extra halachot, okay? So because of this second time it says edim when it wasn't necessary, that tells me that the two or three that is being referred to in the pasuk is not being specific. I don't mean two or three, but not four or five or six. I mean two or three is my paradigm. But really, it extends to even 100, right? And 100 extends to even 1,000,000, okay? 100 is just like the biggest number of people they could imagine coming together for this, but there is no limit, okay? So what this Mishnah is saying, which is both straightforward and like when you think about it, like a big deal, is a set of witnesses is two or more. And a set of witnesses that is made up of two members is not any stronger than a set of witnesses that is made out of 100 people. So in this scenario, okay, witnesses A are 100 people strong. Witnesses B are just two little guys, Beryl and Schmerl, okay? And even though witnesses B are just two people, their testimony is not only as powerful as the first witnesses, it's even more powerful than the first witnesses because they get to say, you are all Edim Zomimim and you are all going to absorb a consequence. Okay, so that's the first Mishnah that we're looking at. We're going to complicate the picture a little bit. The next piece of the Mishnah is Rabbi Shimon said, just as two witnesses are not put to death until both have been incriminated as perjurers, ad shehiyu shneihem zomimin, so too three are not put to death until all three have been incriminated as perjurers. And how do we know that this applies even to 100? Okay? The Torah says, Edim, witnesses. What Rabbi Shimon is doing here is very subtle. He's saying, yes, if you want to look at the numbers and you want to look on the facts of the ground, we look at a set as a set, and it doesn't matter how many members there are in the set. However, if I, witnesses B, want to testify that witnesses A were, it was impossible for them to have seen what they saw because they were with us, Imanu Hayitam, okay? I have to be able to say about every single member of witness of set A that they were all in the wrong place at the wrong time, okay? So it's not that hard for two people to know about and testify about the whereabouts of two people, okay? But it might be a lot harder for witnesses B to be 100% sure that they saw all 100 members of the group A in a different location. Okay, so even though from a very technical perspective, two is not less strong than 100, right? 102 is the same because they're both considered to be one set of witnesses. Rabbi Shimon says, yeah, but practically, if witnesses A have a very large number of members, that makes the job of witnesses B much more complicated because they have to be able to establish the whereabouts of every single person that's in that group. And the larger that group is, the harder it is to ascertain the whereabouts of all of them. If anybody has ever been on a field trip, right, you know that the larger the group of people there is, okay, the harder it is to keep track of where everybody is at any given time. So even though technically 2 and 100 are just as strong, practically it's much harder to unseat a set of witnesses that have 100 members because you can't say proof positive where those people were at the time. Okay, so Rabbi Shimon comes and he says, he's very clever, right? He's like, don't just look at the technical. Yes, 2 and 3 equals 100. Look at the reality. If I want to be an Edomim, it actually is in my best interest to bring a lot of friends because that makes it a lot harder for somebody else to be able to testify positively, convincingly, that we couldn't have seen what we claimed that we saw. Okay. I'm going to summarize these two Mishnayot again, and then we're going to go into the third. Okay, depending on how, like, you're looking at your Mishnah, these many printings have these as one large mega Mishnah, but I felt like for the purposes of comprehension, it would be better to split them into three. So I'm referring to them as individual Mishnayot, but if you're looking at the, like, little, you know, headings here, right? It says 1-7, 1-7, 1-7. It's the same Mishnah. Okay. Mishnah number one says, it doesn't matter how many people are in the set. If I've got three people testifying against two people or two people testifying against three people, they're considered to be one set. It's equal. Okay. So it's not a test of numbers. Okay. And if any of you know anything about the history of juries, okay, actually the core history of juries was actually about trying to get as many people as you could to be sort of part of your witness group. Okay. That was the first mission. The first mission was 3 versus 2 is the same. The second mission was like, yeah, but 3 versus 2 isn't really the same, right? Rabbi Shimon says, but actually, since you have to be able to testify positively about each person in the group, it's much harder to testify against 100 people. Okay, now we have Rabbi Akiva come in, and he says, Lo bahashlishi lahakel ela lahachmir alav vela asotino kayote be'elu. The third witness was only mentioned in order to be stringent upon him and make his judgment the same as the other two. Okay, essentially, it only takes two people to lie. It only takes two people to establish the eyewitness testimony, whether that testimony is true or false. You only need two people. If a third guy comes along, theoretically, he could say, I'm extra. I'm a literal third wheel. Why am I being punished? I'm not load-bearing. Okay? All of this could have been done without me. Let me off the hook. Okay? And then Rabbi Akiva says, aha, the reason why we say 2 or 3 is that if this third guy comes along, hey, you guys going to court? Me too. Can I get a lift? Sure. They all come to the court together. Okay, even though two of them are only load-bearing witnesses, and one of them is just a guy that came along for the ride, he also gets the same punishment. Okay, la'asotino kayote be'elu. He gets the same exact consequence. And the Rabbi Akiva says, and this comes to teach us a lovely lesson. And if scripture thus penalizes one who consorts with those who commit a transgression, as if he is actually one of those who commits the transgression, how much more so shall he who consorts with those who perform commandments receive reward as if he is actually one of those who performs the commandments? Right? So essentially, Rabbi Akiva says, watch the company you keep. If you're going to be the third wheel for someone who's about to be an Eid Zomeim, you're going to get killed. You're going to get whatever consequence he gets, even if you haven't done anything. But you know what? That teaches me a lesson. It teaches me to also try to hang out with people that are doing mitzvot. Okay? Even if I'm not critical to doing that mitzvah, if I'm around, if I'm aiding and abetting in some way the performance of that mitzvah, I'm also going to get credit. Okay, so Rabbi Akiva does this nice, like, little twist where he says, just like the third guy hasn't accomplished anything, and nevertheless he's punished, so too you could find a scenario in the positive direction where you're not accomplishing anything, but you still get credit. I mean, this is not exactly like a perfectly analogous case, but if you ever go, like, pay a shiva call with someone else, and you're not the person who's, like, great at the whole conversation making at the shiva house, and so you just let your friend or your spouse, you know, take the lead. They're doing all the heavy lifting, but you get the same mitzvah. So it's good to hang out with people who are doing mitzvah. Okay. We are going to do one more mishnah. This is like a real exercise in, what's the word I'm looking for? Stamina. Mishnah stamina. Okay. We are going to... Actually, no. I'm going to pause here at the end of Mishnah. Zion, the 7th Mishnah. I'm going to stop my share for any questions, and then we'll go on to the 8th Mishnah. Okay, great.
Is Rabbi Shimon making a judgment or merely pointing out that it's harder?
He is not making a judgment. He's merely pointing out that it's harder. But by doing that, he's kind of making fun of the first position, right? Because the first position says, well, 3 and 2 is the same. And Rabbi Shimon says, no, but when you're actually trying to testify against these people, when you look at it in the real world, 2 and 3 does not end up being the same. But he's not really making a judgment. I think if the first person who spoke in the Mishnah were pushed against the wall and asked, do you agree with Rabbi Shimon? They would say yes.
So it's kind of like pointing out that the first piece of the Mishnah is idealistic.
I don't think that he's saying that it's idealistic. I think that he's saying the technical reality and the lived reality are not identical. Technically, 3 and 2 are equivalent. They are the same. And technically, 2 and 100 are equivalent. They are exactly the same. But when you are actually in the process of bringing your evidence and trying to actually establish that witnesses A couldn't have been where they said they were when there's 100 witnesses A, it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to unseat them, right? It's very unlikely that you're going to be able to get them to the point where they're punished. It's a good question, sort of like, do we need what Rabbi Shimon is saying? Because this is one of the rare moments in the Mishnah where someone's just like, wants to make sure you understand, right? That like, don't let the technical law get in the way of your understanding the reality on the ground. And also you could look at it as an advice to the Edim Zomamim. Hey, if you want to get away with this, get more people to come with you to court. It's going to be harder. Pro tip from Rabbi Shimon.
So just to make sure I understand it correctly, what the Mishnah is saying is that like, if there's two like Edim Zomamim, which are like false witnesses, it doesn't matter. Like to prove that they're wrong, you have to prove like all three or all two are wrong.
Yeah, you have to be able to positively establish that all 2, 3, 4, a million people were nowhere near the scene of the crime and they couldn't have seen it.
But then my other question is that like, let's say like you have this group of people and you establish that one is false, then do you accept the testimony of the other two in condemning the presumed criminal in this case?
Like, this is a great question. And this is going to be unpacked a little bit in Mishnah 8. So this is a very nice segue. Essentially, right, we have to figure out, let's say I have 10 people. Is that one set of witnesses with 10 members? Or is that 5 individual sets of witnesses? And that would mean that if one of them gets disqualified, that's fine. We'll just bring the next set, right? That's essentially your question. Right. If I have enough people to have multiple sets of witnesses, right, 2 or 3 in the Mishnah makes a lot of sense because 3 cannot be split into another set of witnesses. But if I had 4 or more, right, theoretically, I could subdivide into 2 different sets of witnesses. So we're going to see a little bit how that plays out. It's a question that comes up a lot, not so much in this like world of testimony, but it comes up a lot with Edut HaChodesh, with testifying about seeing the new moon. There, like the rabbis do whatever they can to make sure that as many people as possible could come so that they could have as many sets of witnesses as possible. And they do subdivide and try to find the most optimal pairings of people in order to get the testimony.
That makes sense.
Okay, makes sense. Excellent. Great. I see somebody else unmuted. Stephen, is that a way of raising your hand?
I'm going to ask something based upon today's content. You may not wish to answer, or you may feel it's inappropriate.
Okay.
At the current time, with witnesses, we have 2 or 3 versus several hundred. Okay. 2 or 3 weren't there. Several hundred were. What does the Mishnah say, or what would be appropriate in that situation?
Right. So that gets back really to Joel's question.
And you may figure out what I'm referring to.
I don't want to talk about what you're referring to.
I know. I know you don't.
Okay, good. I'm going to answer your question, and then we're going to move on to Mishnah 8. Right. Essentially, your question in our Mishnah is about whether or not you could subdivide, right, that group of people. And so that way, if 2 or 3 of them are out, that's fine. I have plenty remaining. We are going to see that case in the Mishnah. Okay, I'm going to share my screen. We're going to move on. Okay, we're in the second page. We're at Mishnah Makot 8. We're moving so fast. Okay. Just as in the case of 2 witnesses, if one of them was found to be a relative or otherwise disqualified, their whole testimony, right? Their whole evidence is going to be rendered void. So it is with 3. If one of them was found to be a relative or otherwise disqualified, the whole evidence is void. How do we know that this is the case even with 100? The Torah states witnesses. Okay, so the next Mishnah is essentially getting to this exact question where I know if I have 2 witnesses and then I find out that they're brothers, okay, they're both out, right? The testimony is disqualified. Or if I, and the category of pasul is, what if I find out that somebody's not trustworthy, Okay. Not trustworthy people cannot be witnesses. Okay. So if I have a group of three people, one of them gets disqualified for being a relative or for being in another way pasul, the whole set is thrown out. That is the case for 100 witnesses. If they are all in the same barrel, okay, one rotten apple is going to disqualify the whole bag. Okay, that's the first opinion. If these people are considered to be one cot, one set of witnesses, as soon as one of them gets disqualified, the whole testimony is batel. Now remember, there is like a middle level between eid zomeim and we accept your testimony. The middle level is your testimony just gets thrown out. Okay, so edutan batela just means the testimony gets thrown out. There's no consequences for these witnesses. Okay, and then Rabbi Yossi says, well, wait a minute. When is this true? With regards to capital cases. But in monetary suits, the evidence may be established by the rest. Rabbi Yossi says, listen, when we're talking about a capital case, we're going to do whatever we can to preserve life, okay? And so we're not going to condemn someone to death if any small percentage of this large group of witnesses turns out to be no good. But, okay, if it's a Dine Mamonot, if it's a financial case, okay, monetary suit, then I'll just kind of peel off the people that are bad. And titzkayim ha'idut bashar, and then I'm going to let the evidence be established by the rest. Okay, and then Rabbi says it is one and the same rule, both in monetary suits or capital cases. Okay, so Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi agree, and Rabbi Yossi is the odd man out. And Rabbi Yossi's like, well, if it's a monetary case, can't we just peel off the bad guys and use the rest? Okay, ve'ematai, and when does this happen? Bisman shehit rubahan. This is the rule when the disqualified witnesses warned the transgressor. But when they did not warn him, what could two brothers do who saw someone killing a person? Okay, this is a very roundabout way to say there are essentially two kinds of witnesses. There are witnesses who have established themselves as witnesses. And they, like, let's say, like, at the signing of a document, right? They're the people who are the signatories. They're signing the document. They're there as the testifiers to this happening. But there might be plenty of other people walking around working at the bank who could casually see it, okay? So there's essentially people who have been established as official witnesses with a capital W. And then there are people who happen to see. Okay. And generally, if something is going to be like a capital case, it is very unusual for someone to have established themselves as a witness before the event. Usually the way that you're going to get testimony is by what I'm going to call accidental witnesses, right? People that happen to see it. Okay. And the way that the Mishnah imagines that we distinguish between these two categories is through hatra'ah, through warning. The classical case of establishing that I am your witness is if I tell you, hey, don't do this thing. I warn you, don't do this thing. If you do this thing, you're going to get killed by the court and I'm watching you. Okay. And then the person's like, oh, you are? And then kills him anyway. Okay. That's a case of hatra'ah. The person who spoke up in the beginning, they are the official witnesses. Okay. But, and in that case, right, if any member of those official witnesses gets disqualified, then the whole set gets disqualified. But if they are casual, accidental observers who then turn into witnesses, okay, then this disqualification doesn't make any sense. Okay, what if, God forbid, there is a murder in the middle of a football game? What are the chances that of the 10,000 spectators, none of them are going to be related? It's not possible. And then we're just going to say, oh, well, then that person's going to get off the hook because by happenstance, some of the passersby were related. So in that case, okay, where they didn't establish themselves as the witnesses, we don't know of them yet as a kat, as a set. Then if some of them are related or some of them are no good, then we can reconfigure the group to establish that the people that come to court are going to be valid. Okay, now it is true, it is very possible for there to be kind of a middle case here that the Mishnah isn't talking about, where we didn't establish ourselves before, but we all decided to go together as a group and established ourselves as valid witnesses in the court. And then as the judges are, you know, investigating us as witnesses, they find out the two of us are related. In that case, it would also be thrown out. Okay, so I'm going to say this one more time, because the way that the language of the Mishnah is very colorful, but sometimes that makes it confusing. Essentially, we have a machloket. We have this dispute about whether or not, if there is one bad apple, all of the witnesses get thrown out. Or if we just say, titkayim ha'idut bashar, let's pick out the apples that are still good and make a new set of witnesses out of them, right? And then we say, well, with monetary cases, some people think you could do it and some people think that you can't. But then we further say, when we talk about throwing out a whole group of witnesses because one of them is bad, that only makes sense in a scenario where they have already established themselves as witnesses, okay? But if they just happen to see it, and in that large group of spectators, there were people who were related, we're not going to throw out the case because some of the potential witnesses are related. Okay, and now the Gemara is going to kind of go through some of the on the ground, right? Some of the practical, what does this look like in real life? What do we say to them? Rava said, this is what we say to them. Lemechaze atitu o la'ashude atitu. Did you come to observe or did you come to testify? Right? When you, I shouldn't say testify here. This is probably when you use someone else's translation. You're not always happy with it. Okay. So essentially we say to them, hey, when you came to this event, were you coming together as witnesses? Okay. Or were you coming to watch? And you didn't know you were going to see something and you didn't think that you guys were going to be witnesses together. If they say, la'ashude atu, we came to witness, and one of them is found to be a relative or disqualified, then their testimony is invalid. But if they say, we came to observe, right? What are two brothers to do who saw one person who killed another? Rava here is essentially spelling out what I said to you in my narration of the Mishnah, which is the Mishnah distinguishes between two kind of extreme cases. The case where someone warned someone before they did the act, and the case where someone happened to have seen it, okay? And Rava says, well, we can also just find out, hey, when you were there, were you, did you think of yourselves as together as witnesses, or did you think of yourself as people that were just there to watch? Okay, what I think is kind of at issue with me versus the translation of this text is, as Rava is saying, this investigation is about what they saw when the action happened? Or is this investigation about what they say when they arrive to court? Hey, did you come to court to testify? Or did you come to court to observe? That doesn't make any sense. I will show my hand that if I don't have a good translation, I will ask ChatGPT to translate, because in my experience, ChatGPT is better than almost every human translator. Here's a case where ChatGPT fell down on the job. Okay, and the ChatGPT thought it was talking about what happens in the court, and that's why they translated it as testified. But actually, what Rava is talking about is what happened live, right? We say to them, hey, when you were at this event, did you think you were at this event as witnesses, or did you think you were at this event as casual observers? And if you thought you were there as casual observers, I can pluck off one of you from your brother and then attach you to another casual observer and change you into magic into witnesses. Okay, I think we already really spelled this piece out, so I wanna get to Mishnah Makot 1-9. And then if people have questions, you could ask on Mishnah 8 and Mishnah 1-9 when I pause, because I'm conscious of the time and we gotta get through our Mishnah Blitz so that we are very well educated about how to construct a set of witnesses. Okay. Hayushnaim ro'inoto michalon ze. V'shnayim ro'in oto mechalon ze. V'echad matrevo be'emza. We have a lot of people. Two people are looking from one window. Two people are looking from another window. And there is a warner in the middle. Okay, where essentially what we're saying is, how do we link up people who saw the event from different vantage points? Our people are physically separate as they're witnessing. Do they form two separate cots, right? Two separate sets, or can they be linked? The image here is, you know, it's very Kitty Genovese, right? There's people like high up in this window and that window, and then the action is happening down below, okay? So we've got two people looking from one window, two people looking from the other, but there's a person in the middle who is giving the warning and saying, hey, we see you and I'm watching you and don't do what you're about to do. Okay. Then if some on the one side and some on the other can see one another, they constitute together one body of evidence. But if they cannot see one another, then they are two bodies of evidence. Okay. So essentially we're saying, well, it depends if they have sight lines to each other. If they have sight lines to each other and they have sight lines to the action, then they are considered to be one group. Okay, this is also, incidentally, how you make a minion. You also make a minion through sight lines. Okay, it's not just being able to hear. You don't have to be able to see everybody in the room, but one person needs to be able to see one person, and like through like a link of seeing, you get 10. That's how you make a minion. Okay. Consequently, if one of these is found to be a perjurer, both the transgressor and those two witnesses are put to death. Oh, sorry, I skipped a line. It's a very important line. But if they cannot see one another, then they are two bodies of evidence. Consequently, if one of these is found to be a perjurer, both the transgressor and those two witnesses are put to death, while the other group of witnesses is exempt. Okay, very confusing, but very exciting. In this scenario, there are five witnesses. In scenario A, all of the witnesses could see each other, and therefore they're considered to be one set. Okay, so in order for their testimony to be accepted, all five of them need to be valid. Right? Because they're one set. But if it's a case where they can't see each other, then I essentially have two witnesses that are looking from one window and two witnesses that are looking from another window. Now, I'm going to call the first set of witnesses, witnesses one, and the other set of witnesses, witnesses A. Okay, so we don't get confused. Witness B is always the people who testify, hey, you couldn't have seen it. Okay, so essentially what happens is the first set of witnesses, witnesses one, come to court and they say, we saw Bob kill Margaret. Bob killed her. We saw it. And then witnesses B come and they say, what are you talking about? You couldn't have possibly been there. You were with us at a wedding. You did not see Bob kill Margaret. But waiting in the wings is another set of witnesses. This witness is A. The witnesses A come, they say the exact same thing as witnesses one. Okay, they say, we saw Bob kill Margaret. Okay, so in that scenario, witnesses one get killed because they are Edim Zomamim, according to what witness B said. Witnesses A, who said the exact same thing as witnesses one, but their testimony was never contradicted. And they're a whole different set of witnesses. They're not connected to witnesses one. Their testimony is accepted. And therefore, Bob gets put to death for killing Margaret, and witnesses one get put to death for being Edim Zomamim, even though the thing that they were testifying about is obviously true, because we end up killing Bob, because we end up saying that Bob has been established to be a murderer. I know this is very confusing, but it's fun. I'm going to say it one more time because I want to make sure we're all on the same page, okay? Like a set of witnesses that see each other from a window, I want to make sure we're all on the same page. Essentially, we're imagining there is a murder in the alley. And there's two people in one window and two people in another window. And we want to know, hey, is that one set of four or five witnesses? Or is that two sets of two? So we say, if they can see each other and there's a person in the middle who like clearly establishes that everybody who is with him is an official witness, okay? If they're one group of five, if any one of them gets disqualified, they're out, okay? Their testimony isn't accepted. But what if there's a scenario where we have two entirely separate sets of witnesses who saw the same event? We're going to call them witnesses one and witnesses A. Witnesses one saw the event, went to the court and said, we saw the event. We saw Bob kill, what did I say? Margaret, okay? But then witnesses B come and they say, witnesses one, how could you possibly say what you said? You were with us. We know that you're lying. You're Adim Zomamim, okay? On the word of witnesses B, witnesses one get put to death. They were lying. They couldn't have seen what they said they saw. Out of the wings comes witnesses A. And witnesses A come and they say, oh yeah, for sure Bob killed Margaret. We were right there. We saw it. So Bob is killed, okay? And the Adim Zomamim, even though it appears that from the facts of the case, they must have been telling the truth, okay? Because when another set of witnesses said the exact same thing, Bob got killed because he was a murderer, okay? Nevertheless, we kill the first set of witnesses, witnesses one. This is the extreme manifestation of what we learned last week, right? It's very nice how like it comes back to what we learned last week. We're saying it is so clear that the thing that makes you an Eid Zomeim is when somebody else comes and says, you couldn't possibly see it. And it has nothing to do with whether or not the facts of the case are proven or disproven. Because in this scenario, the fact of the case was positively proven and so proven that Bob did get killed. Okay. And so even though we have proof positive that what the first witnesses said happened did happen, we still don't know that they are telling the truth because they are claiming that they saw it. And that is being contradicted, even though what happened has been established through another set of witnesses. Okay. And then Rabbi Yossi says, "Le'olam ein neharagin ad sheyehu shnei edim matrin bo." Rabbi Yossi says, actually, just to be clear here, you actually can never put someone to death without hatra'ah. Okay, this is a minority opinion, but it's a very important opinion. It comes up a lot in the Talmud because it says, al pi shnayim edim, that you kill someone by two witnesses. That essentially the witnesses have to verbally establish themselves as witnesses. They need to clarify with the perpetrator that he knows that what he's doing is wrong. And after all that verbal work has happened, then if the witnesses see it, they testify about it. Okay. And Rabbi Yossi is kind of pointing out here, like the cute, technical footwork when the derivation from the verse is, if I wanted to say it was about what the witnesses saw, I wouldn't say al pi shnayim edim, by their word, I would say by their vision. Okay. Since the pasuk goes out of its way to say by their word, Rabbi Yossi is assuming, aha, they need to have done something with their mouths first. They needed to have established themselves verbally first as the witnesses in order to be the ones who are later going to testify and put someone to death on that power. Okay, and then there's another interpretation, right? Because we need to figure out what al pi shnayim edim means. It's too weird to just leave alone. So another interpretation is a pishnayim edim by the mouth of two witnesses, that the Sanhedrin shall not hear the evidence from the mouth of an interpreter. Here, the same pasuk a pishnayim edim doesn't tell me anything about warning. But what it tells me is we have a very, very strict policy against hearsay. Okay? We cannot have someone testify in court, oh, I heard that someone else saw. The person who saw has to be the one who testifies. So what are we going to do? Okay, if the person who witnessed it speaks Spanish, okay, but the judge still only speaks English. And then so the witnesses who speak Spanish talk to the interpreter, and then the interpreter tells the judge, okay, according to this opinion, that is considered to be hearsay, and you do not accept the testimony through a translator. Okay, this is the source of the idea that the judges on the Sanhedrin knew all 70 languages, right? Because the rabbis needed to hold both things at the same time. They both had to hold this very strict standard against hearsay, which states that you cannot hear the testimony through an interpreter, because essentially the interpreter could be interpreting, right? Not just translating. And therefore, we cannot accept the testimony. But also, we don't want to be in a situation where we're just throwing out good testimony because the people happen not to speak a certain language. So the rabbi said, well, that's how we know that in order to be on the Sanhedrin, you basically needed to understand all the languages. Okay, whether or not that was actually historically accurate, I will leave you to ponder. Okay, I'm not going to take a stand on that. Okay, let us just do the last little story because I want to make sure that there's time for questions. Hanhu Laozi. There were certain people who spoke a foreign language who came before Rava. Rava set up an interpreter between them. And then the Gemara says, wait, what? The Mishnah just told me that we're not allowed to hear testimony through an interpreter. So what's going on here? How could he do this? Did we not learn that the Sanhedrin should not hear the testimony through an interpreter? And then the Gemara answers, Rava understood what they were saying, but he did not know how to respond in their language, right? Essentially, right, the translator was not for Rava to hear, but for Rava to speak. And I think also, you know, this scenario actually feels like very familiar. I think a lot of us, and we use Spanish as an example because it's, you know, the second most commonly spoken language in the States, that like a lot of us could basically like know enough Spanish to know if the interpreter was like totally making things up, but maybe not know enough Spanish to like be sure that we've understood everything that a person who's speaking to us in Spanish has said, right? So the Gemara is saying, oh, the interpreter is for Rava to explain what he's saying. But I think also it might be likely that like Rava understood enough to know whether the interpreter was kind of making things up, but still felt like he needed the extra confidence, he needed the extra boost of the interpreter making sure that he understood. Okay, now we're going to tell another story. Love a good story. Ila and Tuvia were relatives of the guarantor. Okay, Rav Papa thought to say, with respect to the borrower and the lender, they are not relatives, okay? Basically, here's the scene. Ila and Tuvia want to testify in this financial case. They are not related to the actual plaintiffs. They're not related to the borrower, and they're not related to the lender. But they are related to this third party. They're related to the guarantor. So Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yoshua, said to Rav Papa, if the borrower does not have money, does the lender not go after the guarantor, right? So even though he's not one of the official plaintiffs, the guarantor for sure has a stake in the outcome of this case and does not want the outcome to come out in a way where he might eventually be roped into pay. Okay, so the conclusion here is essentially that people who are relatives of the guarantor are also disqualified. And the reason why I think the Gemara brings this piece and the reason why I wanted you to see it is that the Mishnah talks about people being connected through like being able to physically see or being able to physically hear. And those are the like physical connections between people. And, you know, we talk about it being sort of triangulated through this Warner or triangulated through an interpreter, right? There's this very nice parallelism that the Warner in the middle, right? He removes the friction between the two different sets of witnesses in the windows and makes them one set of witness. And the interpreter creates friction, right? I wanted to say something directly to the court, and the interpreter acts as someone that basically drives a wedge between what the witnesses are saying and what the court is hearing, and it's considered to be hearsay. And then the story with the guarantors is telling you, yeah, and whenever you're trying to map out witnesses, map out the relationships the whole way, right? This is a third dimension where somebody is not directly related. They're not related to the plaintiffs. They're not related to the lender. They're not related to the borrower, but they are related to the borrower's guarantor. Okay. And in that way, they are connected in this web, right? They are connected from their relatives of the guarantor who is invested in directly the outcome of this case. So they are indirectly the relatives of the people in this case, of the litigants, and therefore they're also disqualified. So I just thought it was like a nice story that kind of draws home the importance of really mapping out these webs, right? Really trying to figure out, are these people independent or are all these people actually connected to each other? Okay, that leaves us with 5 minutes for questions.
Seems to me that this screams out in modern times for an independent and honest judiciary. It means that there is so much consequence for the outcome of any observation or witness that the judges better be very keen on what the law is and what the difference between an observer and a witness is.
Right. So just to bring us back into the text that we're studying, we talk a lot about the relatives of the edim, but the same way that you're not allowed to have a witness be a relative, you're also not allowed to have a judge be a relative.
Right.
So the same rules of disqualification for witnesses also apply for judges. And so it's important to remember, right, that we're kind of talking about the purity and the integrity of the witnesses, but that same insistence on, you know, who saw what and how do they see and how are they connected also applies to the judges. Yeah. Good. Deborah.
I have so many questions. But I'm going to ask two and you can like answer whatever you feel like. So one is, it feels like underlying this, there's kind of an assumption that people will lie and act according to their self-interest. And another strand of questions that I have is, I can really read this as being disempowering to the stranger and wondering how we square that with all the ways we're told to love the stranger and take care of the stranger.
So the answer for the stranger is this myth that we have of the rabbis and the Sanhedrin knowing all the languages. Because for exactly that reason, they don't want to imagine a court system that disenfranchises someone who happens to speak a different language. So they figure out a way, right, for nobody to be disenfranchised. Don't worry, no matter what language you speak, the rabbis in the court will understand you. Now, you're right that, you know, actually, that could be a problem, right? Because in real life, do we really believe that everybody who's a judge is going to know all of the languages? So like, I think that that's part of, they're trying to do two things at once. And you're right, in real life, it might end up being that a person who has really good testimony, right, is not going to be able to share their testimony. I will say, right, that in terms of disenfranchising, we're not saying that the plaintiffs need to be able to speak the language. We're only saying that witnesses that they bring or witnesses that happen to see something need to be able to speak the language. That makes it, I would say, 6% better, not 100% better, but a little bit better. And now I forgot your first question. Just say one word that will remind me of your first question.
Underlying assumption that people will be lying or...
Oh, yes. The underlying assumption is that people can lie. I don't think... If our underlying assumption was that people do lie and they lie at every opportunity, there would be no way for us to have a judicial system that relied on testimony, right? We'd just be like, people are liars. Let's throw it all out. Okay. But we also can't just be Pollyannish and say like, well, nobody ever lies. I actually had this great realization this morning where, you know, somebody left the emergency exit and they held open the door. 20 people came into the subway without paying because somebody was there opening the door for them. Some of these people were older. Those people were never going to jump over the turnstile, right? These people were not committed to cheating the fare. But when the door was open for them and everybody else was filing in like a, you know, like a stream of cheating ducks, right? They also came in and they also skipped the fare. And I think that that's more the reality that we have, like, if it's too easy to lie and it just seems like natural and it's just like the flow of the game, human beings are very fallible. And we sometimes will go for what is easy and convenient and beneficial, even though we know that we shouldn't.